I think we're also in the last decade of a super cycle, big macro cycle. And I define a super cycle as the big cycle between two depressions, the 1930s being the last depression. I think the 2030s, probably mid 2030s and beyond, being the next depression. So we're in the last decade of a super cycle, and everything goes crazy. That's why we've seen what we've seen in this last 5 years, and really the last 15 or 20 years. But and it just gets more extreme. What it's going to take to pull us out of that bust, in my opinion, is probably going to be something on the order of 20 trillion in new QE. That's just the Fed, proportionally similar around the central banks around the world.
David Hunter, good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
Good, Andy. Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you. I want to start out with I've been following you for a while, it seems like years, and you've had some remarkable calls. I am sure you have been wrong, but I can't seem to find it. And everybody's wrong at times, by all means, but it's been really remarkable. Recently, I was listening to a recent interview a month or two ago, and you were making the comment that, or the observation that we're more than likely going to go, or you wouldn't be surprised that we're going to go into a blow-off top here towards the end of the year. Do you still hold that opinion? And where it certainly seems like that, but yeah, where are we that in all of that with the S&P and stocks?
Yeah, that's still my opinion. It's been my opinion for quite a while that this thing would end in a melt up or a blow off top. That I think we would probably go parabolic in the end. This is a 43-year secular bull market, in my opinion, that is coming to an end. So it started in August of 1982. And if you ever look at some of the stocks that kind of have blow offs, that's what happens is they have runs and the slope just gets steeper. And then finally, in the end, they go almost vertical. And I think we're seeing the same thing happen here in the stock market. I think we have entered what I call the parabolic phase, which means the next 2 or 3 months, we could cover an awful lot of ground in a very big hurry.
Yeah, and my question would be my follow-up question to that, why would we go parabolic now as opposed to the previous years? And again, usually, typically, if you can make it through October, you have a really strong end of the year with Wall Street bonuses. But is that your guesstimation here?
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with Wall Street bonuses or very little to do with that. I think what it is you've had the institutions from certainly from October of 2022, all the way up from the bottom at 3,500 on the S&P, the institutions have looked at this very skeptically and said, we're not, the first they thought it might go a few hundred points. And then, when we got up to the old highs at 4,800, they said, okay, maybe we go a little higher, but they were looking at it as a bear market rally until then. Then they said, yeah, okay, I accept we're in a bull market, but they didn't think it'd go a lot higher. And then they kept raising targets. And now you're starting to see a sprinkling of them say 7,000, but most of that is out a year. I mean, so, most of them are kind of concentrated in that mid 6,000s range, 6,500, 600, 700. And that's a far cry from where they were just a few months ago. And they remain cautious, I think. They remain skeptical. Yes, they're acknowledging that they've got to get on board, that the momentum is there, but they have one foot out the door all the time. I think until that changes, you're still in a healthy bull market. So yes, we're getting to the end. We could be a few months from the end of a 43-year secular bull market, and I think the highs of this bull market will probably stand as the highs for decades. So we're not very far from a top, and yet, my targets are saying that we have, at least 30% and maybe even more upside from here. And that we might get that all before the end of the year. Doesn't have to, as I say, the market could top out before the end of the year, or it could push into first quarter of next year. As I say, the market doesn't turn into a pumpkin on December 31st at midnight. So, calendar doesn't really matter, but I would not be surprised if we cover that whole big run-up in this year.
Got it. Who and what is fueling that? Because, as you mentioned, the analysts or the big analysts or big traders, even if you would, they have one foot out the door. And everything I read, they've been skeptical now for, as you mentioned, for years, a couple of years here. They just got it wrong. So who's pushing this up? Is it the retail investor? Is it foreign money? What is it?
So retail has been remarkably from Liberation Day last April, the bottom. The retail has been surprisingly bullish, while the institutions were very bearish. In the early April when we went down, had that 20% swoon. I turned bullish below 5,000. I turned more bullish. I was already talking about 8,000 on the S&P. I raised my target below 5,000 when everybody else was lowering targets and saying we're in a bear market now, the top's in. I said we're going to 8,700. So I raised at that time, and that's how I'm a contrarian. That's how I work. Is the sentiment got so negative, I got more bullish, and that's the same story here. Is that the institutions remain skeptical, and that what I call a wall of worry is the fuel for the future advance. So what you don't want is everybody all in. Once everybody's all in, that's already been acted on. So the reason I'm so bullish is because, again, in spite of the fact that we're at all-time highs or very close to all-time highs right now, sentiment remains subdued. And that means there's plenty of ability for, there's plenty of fuel for future advance.
Right. Okay. So why, I guess then, why would it have to end if you would? And I say that in context with the Fed lowering rates here recently. They cut it a quarter of a point. They're coming out dovish. I'm looking at the reaction. The bond market actually bounced up over the yields. Oh, yeah. The bond market's bounced up. Correct me if I'm wrong since then. But the bond market, which is surprising to me, is relatively very strong. Is that sniffing out this, if you would, what's to come after a parabolic? Is that sniffing out a correction? Is that sniffing out a recession?
No, what it really is, we've seen the rates move down from, say, I think they backed up to 460 or up in that range, and they backed down to maybe 4% on the 10-year, very close to it. And then in the last few days, we've backed up to 414, 15, and could go a little higher here. But ultimately, I'm calling for in the next 3 to 6 months, you could see rates certainly down towards 3%, and maybe even below 3,
Whoa.
and then in from there, I can see a 0% 10-year in the global bust that I'm forecasting to follow this. So I think we've seen the highs in rates for a while, for at least the next year, 18 months, it's pretty much gonna that's gonna help fuel the market. Part of the reason the bond market's moving down is because the economy is slowing. Another part of it is because inflation, despite the Fed's worries and some on the streets' worries, inflation continues to trend down. I think we will see, ultimately, we will see 2%, which is Fed's target, and then below that in the next year. I'm saying that the global bust that will follow this will bring on deflation. So we'll have the first. Truly, the first deflationary downturn in 90 plus years. So everybody else is worried about inflation ticking up. I'm saying no. Yes, we've had a couple months of tick up or uptick, but really the trend is down and it remains down. So I think that if inflation's moving down, the Fed's been too restrictive. They've got to catch up. And as I always say, the bond market sees this stuff well before the Fed. The bond market moves. I'm not really worried about how many cuts we have between now and the end of the year. I'm not worried. I wasn't worried whether the Fed was going to get a quarter or a half in September. The bond market's going to take care of that. The bond market in its aggregate is a far better forecaster of what's to come than any Fed official.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. I used to run some money, and we would always watch the bond market in our models, if you would. But you just said the 10-year getting to 0%. That reminds me, I don't remember exactly what it was in 08-ish, 09-ish, but that reminds me of that time. And that was quite scary and violent, if you would. That's what you're saying. That's what we're headed into.
Yeah, so you can even go back less time than that and go back to 2020. The
Yeah.
10-year got down to 0.4. So I'm saying we have one more lower low in rates, one more higher high in bonds, and then that'll be the peak of the secular bond, a bull market in bonds that started in 1981. So bonds in 1981, I think the 10-year was probably 15%, and it's come all the way down, got down to 0.4. And in the last few years, it backed up to 5%. And from here, I mean, from that 5%, I think we've begun the next leg down that will take us down and ultimately take us to new lows. It will be as a result of a very bad economy globally, not just in the US. I am calling for a bust, which I define as something bigger than the Great Recession, but not drawn out like a depression. So it will come with a financial crisis that I think will be bigger than 2008-9, again globally. So some of that damage, banking failures and bank failures around the world, et cetera. I would guess from a banking industry standpoint, the banks overseas are in more trouble this time, whereas we were the lead in 2008. So I think European banks are not, we got some religion because of what happened with subprime and our banking crisis in 2008. Unfortunately, Canada was in good shape then. Canada's made all the mistakes we made back then. They're in much worse shape now. They're much more leveraged and extended. Europe's not in good shape. Obviously, the Asian banks aren't in good shape. We don't know what's going to go on in Japan, but my take is, as a longtime monetarist, you can't keep doing what Japan did without at some point inflation breaking out and interest rates breaking out, and they have no room for error over there. So that could be part of the bust is, the wild card is Japan, I think.
Now, you're talking in deflation here after a parabolic. We're assuming quite possibly have a parabolic spike up, but you're talking about a deflationary time in 26. Where does a person hide? Because that's the problem with deflation. There's really no place to hide except in cash or in really in bonds, right?
Yeah, frankly, it's about right. I'm calling for an 80% bear market, stock bear market. So peak to trough, we had a 90% decline in 29, 29 to 32. This one I think isn't going to be quite that bad, but 80% peak to trough would be the biggest since then. So that certainly means you can't hide in stocks. You can't really hide in lesser quality bonds. Even investment quality is going to be in trouble because the economy is deteriorating so to such an extent. So it means treasuries are pretty much the only game in town in the bond market. And if I'm right that we've moved from 4.15 here down to zero, obviously that's a big gain in the bond market across the curve from T-bills on up to 30-year. I expect the treasuries to outperform everything else. It will be, obviously T-bills won't give you much upside, but it'll give you something. And the long bond will give you a lot. So I think bonds are about the only thing that's going to move up in this. FDIC insured savings accounts, because the FDIC will be provided whatever funds they need to meet their liabilities. So I'm not worried about that not working. Obviously, if you're in institutions beyond the insurance limits, you're at risk. We don't know exactly what will happen there. Money markets last, 2008, they had the we won't break the buck. They backstopped the money markets. My guess is they'll do the same thing again, but we don't know that at this point. So there's some risk in money markets, probably not a great deal as long as you're in pretty good quality ones.
Okay, got it. Well, talk to me about where does gold fit in all of this? I know you're on record. I want to say gold at about 4,000 this year. And I want to say you were calling silver around 75 or at 75 that it could potentially get there. Do you still see that happening in this malaise, or is that part of the parabolic? Where does this fit in your deflationary scenario?
Yeah, those are still my targets. I think we will see those. They don't necessarily have to be totally in sync with the stock market. So the stock market could top out before the end of this year or early next, and precious metals might go, a couple months beyond that. But those are my targets. I think I'm probably going to be proven conservative on those targets. So gold at 4,000, I may have to raise that. We're not that far away, frankly.
We're right there.
Um,
Yeah.
silver's quite a bit away from my target, but I think, as we saw in 2011, when silver gets going, it gets going in a hurry. So if you want to talk about a parabolic, that can go that way. So I'm pretty comfortable with both those targets. Like I said, I may have to raise my gold target. And then in the bust, I think they will, like all assets, get hit. Won't get hit like stock markets. At least gold won't. Let's say gold goes to, and I haven't raised my target, so I'm not saying this, but let's say it goes to 4,500. It could go back to 3,000. That'd be a one-third retracement, right? So that's a lot less than 80% retracement the stocks will see, but it's still a big hit. Silver, which is much more volatile and much more economically dependent. If we go to 75, you might see that back to 30 or below. Might even go back to 25. So they will be hit. As I say, I'm a huge bull on the precious metals post bust. I have a target of 20,000 on gold for the early 2030s, not 2030, but the early 2030s, and silver 500. So I'm obviously those are huge numbers, and those that say, I'm not a trader, I'm just going to buy and hold. If you do that, just know that in the bust, you're going to get hit, and you might get cold feet at the wrong time. You might, once it's down 30 or 40%, say, hey, I don't know, maybe it's going to go down more, I'm getting out. So better to, maybe better to take chips off the table and wait for the bust to happen and then get back in. As I say, it's kind of like standing on the south rim of the Grand Canyon and looking across to the north rim and thinking you can walk straight across. There's this canyon in between called a global bust that's going to influence your thinking all the way through. So, yeah.
David, you mentioned that the institutions are a lot more cautious than the retailers. If you can tell us where the institutions are parking their money now, I mean, how are they allocating? And then also, I'd love to know your thoughts on the true unemployment numbers and the job report that came out.
Okay, so I think institutions, obviously they're all over the lot. The hedge funds probably are more aggressively defensive. I don't track it closely, but I'd say lots of institutions are in more defensive stocks. They may have a higher percentage in, the shorter end of the curve because they haven't been big bond bulls either, but they may be stretching that out and, adding duration to their bond portfolios. I think just in general, they're more defensive than they will be in the next few months. You're just beginning to see, I think, that they recognize this thing could have legs. As we talked about before, the Fed is just starting an easing cycle. So in their minds, that may be, even though my view is that we're approaching a top, the institution, and I expect in the next few months, the institutional view to be that we have a couple of years to run here, and that with the Fed at our back, it's time to get more aggressive. So, they'll get less defensive in their stock portfolio and probably add more equity allocation. All institutions do it differently, so I can't really say.
Adding leverage, and it seems like the smart money is not being very smart. Kurt, you
Yeah,
think?
I said that in April and since is that, we keep calling institutions the smart money, but really this time around, the retail learned their lessons and they're playing this much better than the institutions have.
Talk to me. What do you see after the great deflation that you're forecasting? Give me on the other side of the Grand Canyon. Where would the dollar be? Because again, the Fed, they're going to inflate to get us out of this mess, because that's all they want. They know what to do. The bond market, it seems like as they inflate, I mean, interest rates would go back up to, I don't know, double digits pretty quickly. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then gold, it seems like, would go in a reinflation, just, again, almost parabolic with, talk to me about that.
Let me kind of lead up to that. So the dollar, my current dollar view, and it's been my view for a few years, is that we, in this decline in the dollar from 115, you know, back in 22, I have been saying we could get down to 82. So I think between now and sometime in the first half of 2026, we'll see the dollar down to 82, probably more likely first quarter next year, but
whoa,
who knows? So, yeah. Meaning between now and the end of the first quarter.
Yeah.
So that's a big drop from
that's
here.
A big drop. I don't mean to interrupt you.
The next step, because we've been consolidating around the mid-90s here for a little while, I think it's pretty soon we're going to see it roll out of that, and the next step is 90-ish, and then we'll have another leg down to 82, I think, probably next year. And then in the bust, at some point in the bust, and not early on in the bust, the dollar can get hit. Later on in the bust, I think you'll see a flight to safety, as we always do, into the dollar. So I think you could go all the way from 82 back up to 120. And again, if we're talking about an 80% decline in the stock market here, imagine what the story is around the world. And if Japan blows up, if China blows up, if Canada has real problems, if Europe has real problems, there's not going to be very many places where foreign investors can go. They'll be coming into our treasury market in a big way. And that's a funny thing, is the narrative out there has been all about, what do we do to replace the foreign investor? I go, that's not my worry at all. You know, we don't need stable coins. We don't need anything else, at least in the next year to 18 months. There's going to be plenty of demand from both the Fed and foreign investors, along with domestic investors, institutions. And there won't be enough treasuries to satisfy all the demand. So that's why you get a big drop in rates. So anyway, I think the dollar can have, you know, one last run to 120. And then post-bust, I think we begin a long decline. And part of the long decline is, I believe we're, you know, yes, we're in a, for, you know, the end of a 43-year secular bull market in stocks. I think we're also in the last decade of a super cycle, you know, big macro cycle. And I define a super cycle as the big cycle between two depressions, the 1930s being the last depression. I think the 2030s, probably mid-2030s and beyond, being the next depression. So we're in the last decade of a super cycle, and everything goes crazy. That's why we've seen what we've seen in this last 5 years, and really the last 15 or 20 years. But it just gets more extreme. What it's going to take to pull us out of that bust, in my opinion, is probably going to be something on the order of $20 trillion in new QE. That's just the Fed. Proportionally similar around the central banks around the world. So, and what I'm describing here is, if you go back and start in, you know, post-depression, so 1940s, early 40s, what we've seen is we have these economic cycles. We go boom, bust, you know, and each successive cycle pretty much has taken, they've had to do more to tighten down because inflation was breaking out, and then they went too far, and then it took more to pull us out. And somebody described it as, I was saying, I'm not sure if sine wave or what it is, but somebody said it's kind of a buggy whip type thing I'm describing. So that each successive cycle got more violent or more volatile. And we're now in the last decade where we get to the real extremes of that volatility. You know, we had 2008-9, and you thought that was the big one, right? I think this one's going to be bigger than that. And the problem is with leads and lags, they don't know when to stop. They just know they got to keep going until they stabilize things, right? And if we're getting a dominoing, if we're getting a banking crisis across the world, that's with bank failures dominoing across the world, they can't sit back and say, because Powell has been on record as saying, we're not doing that again. We're not going back to blowing up QE and, you know, bailing out the stock market. So part of the reason we're going to get the bust is because the reaction is exactly that. He's going to be slow to respond. He's going to say, well, we don't want to do that again. We know what happened last time. We don't want to go to 0% interest rates. We don't want to, you know, no interest rate policy. We don't want to get money. You know, we know what money eventually means, inflation. We don't want to do that. That's fine to say until you're staring in the face of this abyss. And then it's deer in the headlights time and they're just pumping money like crazy because there's really no other policy. You can't go to Congress and say, fix this. This stuff's happening minute to minute, day to day, right? We saw that in 2008. You can't go to Congress and say, we're not going to print money. You have to solve it. You know, especially in this time, they couldn't agree on, you know, what to have for breakfast. They'll never agree on how to solve this. You know, you're going to see that it really is the only policy that moves anyway. You're going to see so much money. They'll start slow, meaning slow might be $1 trillion, and, you know, wait a couple weeks or a few weeks and it's still free falling, you know. Then they go to 3 or 4 or 5 trillion and it's still falling. You know, it will take them time to get to a right size policy because that's where I get a lot of pushback because people go, that'll never happen. The Fed would never let that happen. Not on purpose, but if they're reluctant, And it takes some time to recognize that they can't be reluctant. It's in that time that it takes several months for them to get to right size policy that you can just keep going down, going south. So that's the backdrop for the next cycle is if they print, and again, it's seat of the pants, I'm throwing out a number. I don't know whether it's going to be, you know, 18 trillion or 25 trillion or 15, you know, but I think it's somewhere around 20 trillion just from the Fed. If they do that, which is, you know, I have to remind people, in 2008, going into the crisis, the Fed's balance sheet was $875 billion in October of 2008. We went up to 9 trillion during the pandemic. We're now down towards 6 trillion, 6.5 trillion. If we go from 6.5 to say 30 trillion, it's beyond anything we've ever had in this world. And again, add up all the central banks, maybe it's 50 trillion, I don't know what it is, but it's well beyond anything we've ever had before. And because of the lag, they don't know what they're creating. And what they're going to create is a hyperinflationary cycle far worse than the early 80s. And I was investing, you know, I was in institutional investing back in the early 80s. You know, we went to 20% inflation. I think this time we probably peak around 25% in this country. So we go from deflation to by the 2030s, early 2030s, whether that's 32 or 3, wherever, we could be looking at 25% inflation. What does that do to rates? That takes rates from a 0% 10-year to probably a 20% 10-year or certainly easy, high teens.
Yeah.
How do you solve that equation when you've got the kind of debt imbalances we have? We can't finance it at 5%. How do we finance it at 20 or 15? And probably we won't know how to finance it at 10, but and the thing that people don't understand is that once you start seeing inflation, and again, it's going to take a little while. If you go from -3 or 4, you know, the first year out, you might be +2, 3, 4. Second year out, you might be high single digits. Third year out, you might be double digits. Fourth year out, you're probably approaching 15. And fifth or sixth year out, you're approaching 20 and upwards. So it's not that it all happens in 6 months or a year. But it's, you know, you've reversed 40, the reason we've had a 43-year secular bull market is because from the early 80s till now, we've had disinflation with, you know, a couple bumps up. But we go from disinflation to deflation up to inflation and hyperinflation. That's a whole different environment that most people in the investment world have never experienced. I did, because I was back there, and the people that have been around for 50 years have. But for a lot of people, they've only invested in disinflation. So we're into starting next year, some investment environments that they've never seen, and it will be a very different leadership. By the way, if you're printing 20 trillion, you will have, I said before, I thought the peaks of this secular bull market would stand for decades. That doesn't mean you won't have opportunities. The 20 trillion will create a cyclical bull market. If you're down 80% from, let's say, 9,000, you know, down 80% takes you 1,800 on the S&P. 1,800, you could quadruple from 1,800 and still fall far short of that 9,000 peak that we had. So it's a beginning of a secular bear market where you have lower peaks and lower troughs. But if you come out and triple or quadruple out of the bottom, obviously there's some great investment opportunities in that. Just understand that it runs out of gas pretty quickly when it's competing with double-digit interest rates. So it might be a cyclical bull market for a couple of years, but the leadership's going to start dropping off because growth stocks won't be able to, you know, stay up with interest rates moving up so fast. Consumer stocks, you know, consumers not going to be in anywhere near the shape to, you know, even consumer staples and things are going to struggle because they're steady growers. And so it ends up being the commodity sector, the industrial sector, because of all the reshoring we're going to see, you know, select technology. I'm not saying there won't be some real growth areas that can outpace inflation, but, you know, AI or whatever, there'll be some places. But the leadership that we've had the last 15 years, you know, tech and up until more recently healthcare, those areas are not going to be the leadership next cycle. It's going to be, like I said, it's going to be commodities. I think oil can go to $500 a barrel. I'm calling for
$500
a barrel. I'm calling for $30 a barrel oil in 2026 in the bust, and then to go from there over the course of the next 6 or 7 years to $500 a barrel. Natural gas might go to 50. Who knows?
Wow. Well, think about it. It makes sense, though, if you're talking about the printing that you're talking about.
Exactly.
It makes a lot of sense.
What I say is when you print to those extents, mm-hmm. you're creating artificial, you know, it leads to demand. It pushes demand up. But what isn't pushed up, because it takes a decade to build a new oil field, right? You're not going to be able to, supply can't match the demand. Demand goes through the roof because you artificially pushed up demand with all this money. And I can get there from where's that demand coming from? Well, obviously we look and we see, all the energy demand we're going to have from AI. We see, the demand from all the industrial expansion we're going to have, et cetera. So you're going to have demand ramped up and supply, which we've been ratcheting down for decades, particularly with the green energy thing. But, you know, it's you're going to be stuck with a finite supply. And obviously you'll begin a big new exploration period in energy, so that there's going to be great opportunities in, you know, energy exploration and development. But it won't come online fast enough to meet that demand. So what the only thing it can give in that period is price. So we're going to have, you can see the inflation from a, you know, monetarist money standpoint, but you can also see the inflation from the supply demand standpoint in these commodities. You know, copper could go to 20, you know, from 460 now, could go down to one, you know, a buck in the bust, a buck or two, but then go to 20 or higher in the expansion. So you're going to see all this stuff get ramped up. Very different environment than what we've had for the last 40 years. And anybody that's think about the implications for, as I say, anybody that was smart enough to listen to their financial advisors who said it's time in the market, not timing the market, and put their money in index funds back in 1985 and just kept adding to that, they've outperformed most active managers for the last 30 or 40 years. But if you think about the next cycle, with rates moving up as rapidly as I'm talking, you're going to put real pressure on PE multiples. And the things that are the heaviest weighted in the S&P at the end of this cycle will be the worst things to own next cycle in many cases. So it takes a long time for that to get rejiggered, as people sell the losers and buy the new winners. That happens over a decade, or over many years, not over months. So you're going to have the S&P and the NASDAQ and all the other indexes that have done so well for the last 40 years are going to be the laggards relative to if you just put your money in energy stocks or precious metals or copper producers, et cetera. So commodities will be, both commodities and commodity stocks will be the leaders. Lots of industrials, because Caterpillar, for example, is going to have plenty of demand for all those new mines that have to be developed, et cetera. So those are going to be the winners, steel, all that stuff. And then the laggard is going to be all those steady growers that depended on the consumer, depended on, new technology and things like that. Now, semiconductors is a kind of an interesting one, because no doubt AI is here to stay, and no doubt there's going to be more and more demand. So it is the tech commodity sector. So, they may do pretty well, but probably not to the extent we've seen the last 5 years.
Got it. Now, my last question is this is the Great Reset gets thrown out a lot, that word, if you would, or those words or that phrase, if you would. Is this really what you see as a Great Reset here? Is this deflationary cycle and this huge influx of money printing, and then everything would be reset really right before that huge money printing, right? Is that what you're alluding to, if you
will? No, that's obviously the Austrian school's view, the Peter Schiff's of the world out there. I am not in that camp. I do believe that we could see the dollar down to 50 or below by early next decade because of everything I described. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be resetting itself kind of as we go. But so are a lot of the fiat currencies, right? I mean, it's that's not an environment that's going to be good for anybody. We may still be the best dirty shirt in the laundry, in spite of how bad it's going to be for everybody. But I think if you want to call it a reset, to me, the real story is, if you follow this to its logical conclusion, the Fed and every central bank gets taken out of the picture somewhere in the late 2020s. As inflation moves up, you can't print more money. It's just pouring gasoline on the fire, right? You just get more hyperinflation even faster. So at some point, the printing press goes away. It's not available to you. You don't have enough money to pay the interest on your debt, never mind the principal on your debt. You don't have enough money to fund military. You don't have enough money to fund welfare. You don't have enough money to support Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Comes a time, I say it's somewhere between 2033 and 2035, but that's just a guess. Somewhere in there is when I think everything comes crashing down, and basically it's a systemic, this one is a bust. The next one is a systemic unwind around the world. The system we've known for all our lives will be blown up, not by choice, just blows up. and basically I can't even imagine what we're, it's everybody for themselves. It's, good luck. Because think about it. You could have, if you get a depression and you have everything leading up to it that I've described, you could have no welfare system, no unemployment to speak of, limited Social Security and Medicare, and 50% unemployment. What do you have there? And you know, it's basically you better have land and be growing your own food. You better have guns. You know, I don't go there very often, but I mean, that's it. It's hard to imagine what a true blow up of, you know, we've basically mismanaged this thing for 90 years or 100 years, and we're now coming to the end of the Ponzi scheme. And when that Ponzi scheme unwinds, it unwinds big. So, so the bust is kind of the precursor to that. But because we have a printing press still available in deflation, you have almost infinite ability to print because of the leads and lags. You know, for a couple of years, you won't be seeing the results, or at least 18 months. So you have a printing press one more cycle. And that's where I, you know, just to pick a name, Peter Schiff and I would disagree. Is Peter thinks the end is now, right? Or thinks the reset is now, because we have that, because I think we're heading for deflation and we have that printing press, I think it pushes it out one more cycle. But then I have that same view that ultimately, call it a great reset if you want, but I have no idea what comes out of that. It's, you know, it's not, I don't think it's, the Austrians seem to think we can reset and go merrily on our way, right? That we'll just have a gold back system or something. But getting from here to there, I mean, you know, I don't know what comes out of that. Hopefully it's not communism. Hopefully it's not totalitarianism, but who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Steve, did you have any final questions?
So just want to make sure that I'm getting the timeline right. So Bretton Woods 2.0, you're thinking more 2033, 35.
Yeah, that would be, that's what I call the next depression and total systemic collapse. But I don't know that it's any kind of an orderly Bretton Woods 2.0. I really don't know what comes out of that. It's easier to see the damage that comes out of, you know, the destruction that comes out of that. But out of the ashes of that destruction, it's hard to know because, you know, there's a lot of sinister out there too. So,
yeah. So invest in farms and invest in guns.
Yeah. Like I said, you've got, you know, I want to be clear. You've got one more big opportunity next cycle, as long as you're invested properly. And that's why I tell people that people have, you know, cause I've had this view for a while and people go, what do you do in that? And I go, you know, what do you do now to prepare for that? I go, the best thing you can do is get your financial house in order. That means don't ride it down in the bus. Don't stay the course and then come out of, you know, it's a lot harder to be okay coming out of an 80% hit to your portfolio. You know, climbing back, you may never get back. So, you know, preserve your capital in this and take this next several months as an opportunity to preserve capital, put it in places where you can ride it out, and then take advantage of the huge commodity super cycle that will follow. And then just don't get greedy and realize there's a point at which, yeah, maybe it's, you know, get off the grid and buy your guns. I don't know what it is.
And whiskey and cigarettes so you can barter.
yeah, definitely whiskey.
Yeah. David, I want to thank you so much for your time. You're very gracious. You've been very gracious to me. You're so sought after. You're very sought after, but I just want to thank you for your time. If people want to learn more about you, reach out to you, do business with you in your newsletter, how do they do that?
Yeah, I'm on X or Twitter every day. Usually it's all through replies. Occasionally I'll put out an original post, but for those that have not set their settings properly, they may not see me very often, but I'm on there oftentimes replying a couple dozen times a day. So if you're not seeing my posts, it's because you're not set for replies. And I've been around in circles on that one. I guess it's not that easy. If you're on your phone, I think it's an easy set. If you're on a computer, you know, trying to get that setting right so that you see replies. I'm not an expert on that, so I won't give you advice on that. But just know that if you're not seeing me on there, it's because of the settings. And then I do write a quarterly macro letter that is available by subscription. People can direct message me on X and I will provide details.
Excellent. Yeah. And you're very responsive on X. That's how I got in touch with you. David, again, thank you. I'd love to have you on again. maybe in the next quarter, and we'll see where things are at.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Andy.
Very much appreciative. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. Thanks, David.